This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Thomas W. Gilbert about Death in the Strike Zone, the mystery of America's first baseball hero. How are you, Tom?
I'm good.
It's really good to have you here. You know, I'm kind of fanatically a baseball fan my whole life and have read a lot of baseball books. At one time, I think I thought I knew a lot about baseball history, but I have found out that I know far less than I actually thought. And this book is really interesting because you are talking about a period in baseball history that I think most of us know almost nothing about. You can tell this better than I can, but you're talking about baseball in the pre-professional era, pre-baseball as we know it, right up to about 1862.
Yes, that's when my story ends. Although the effects of Jim Creighton's career continue. But there is confusion about this for baseball fans because as a group, they're history conscious and they have long memories. You know, everyone knows who Babe Ruth is and he retired 100 years ago. Of course, there's a lot of history before Babe Ruth. And the thing is that baseball's evolving and changing over 150 years. So there's no real bright lines, even between the amateur era and the professional era. So the standard way of looking at it is that the first National Professional Baseball League was founded in 1871 and lasted for 5 years. It was called the National Association, and it used to be considered a major league by the major leagues, but they've changed their minds, and now they say that the National League we have now, which was founded in 1876, is the first major league.
Right, which they like to obliterate a lot of history when they do that.
They do, and it's not really fair. I mean, I remember talking to a baseball fan in his 20s who basically poo-pooed any baseball history before 1947, because he said it was segregated. Okay, that's an interesting point, but nothing changed very much in 1947. So it's not a very historical way of looking at it, right? I mean, Jackie Robinson is a big change, but it's symbolic of all the changes that came later. It was only a handful of African-American players that came in that.
Well, and also to be fair to history, there were African-American players prior to 1900, actually in the 1880s, who were legally playing baseball, or some who were skirting the rules by being called Cuban.
You have to forget the 19th century to even say that Jackie Robinson is the first player. Anyway, so one thing that I hope people get out of my books is the amateur era is basically all of baseball history, and we don't know when baseball began because it disappears as you're following the path backwards. It's very old, the game. But it's turning into a sport in the middle of the 19th century, the 1840s and 50s. By that, I mean it's getting very organized. And if you look at the big picture of the evolution of baseball from folk game that mostly played by children to actual an adult activity that's taken seriously and that it's very organized, it actually traveled most of that distance before the so-called professional era. So professional baseball is a way to make money off baseball, but sort of baseball existed before it, well before it, and professional baseball and Major League Baseball, they've never been terribly interested in what came before them because they don't really need to care about baseball history. They need to care about themselves.
Right.
It's a profit-making enterprise.
Right. History is interesting to them insofar as it furthers their aims today.
Exactly. That's the Hall of Fame is about professional and Major League Baseball, even though there's a lot of, you know, information there if you go to Cooperstown about early baseball. But the point of it is as an amenity for Major League Baseball.
Right. But I think, you know, what you do in this book, which I think in part is because of the dearth of record keeping in that era and information about the game, is you really are telling the history of America, or at least a portion of America where baseball was being played, mostly in New York and Brooklyn in the 1840s and 50s. And a lot of what you're talking about really is the history of culture as it was changing in mid-19th century.
That's true. And my previous book before that, which was How Baseball Happened, is really examining exactly that, how it spread out from New York. And the short answer to how I was able to discover so much new information about this is you can't look between the white lines. You have to look at everything outside the white lines. Because the answer is to say all the basic questions, why baseball? Why not cricket? Why New York baseball and not Boston's game or Philadelphia's game that are all forgotten? The answer to all these questions has to do with economics, culture, wars, railroads, transportation, media. It has almost nothing to do with sports.
Right. But it is cultural also in that.
Yeah.
Well, without sidetracking, although we aren't, none of this is really a sidetrack, but a lot of this book is about Brooklyn because baseball was such a big sport in Brooklyn. But a lot of what you talked about is sort of the how baseball moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn and maybe with the people who were playing it moving to Brooklyn as well.
That's a big part of it. And, you know, somebody once asked me in an interview, now I don't want to bore everyone because many parts of America had bat and ball games that are all forgotten. And then in Connecticut, they played wicket, which is a variety of cricket. There's all these strange games that are dinosaurs. They're long extinct. So baseball spread across the country and drove all these other competing games, including the British sport of cricket, into extinction in America over a matter of time, period of time. But somebody asked me the question, like, what's the main reason that baseball, which is was called the New York game or the Brooklyn game in the mid-19th century, why was victorious? And after thinking long and hard about it, you know, there's a lot of factors. But the biggest one is that, as I really believe this, is that Philadelphia, there were reasons why it was never going to be a foreign sport, and that has to do with nativism and culture and politics. But the reason why it's New York and not Philadelphia and not Boston and not whatever they were playing in Connecticut or Baltimore, it has to do with the inner city rivalry between New York City and Brooklyn that were separate cities. And there's no such phenomenon in Boston or in Philadelphia. And I think if there had been, it might have been different because, you know, inner city rivalry is the essence of baseball now. And it was at the beginning. It pulled all this energy and it pulled so much energy into the game and fed it and fed the development of it and the perfecting of it that the whole country got turned on to it, even when it was in the period that I'm writing about in my book. It's almost always two Brooklyn teams playing for the national championship every year.
I know. I love the way they call it the national championship, which is so classic because the World Series was, of course, it's not the world. It's just, you know.
Exactly. And but the world was two cities then. But the thing is, the rest of the country was following it with interest. It wasn't that they were being ignored by the sport. They were following it through all the sports publications that came out of New York.
But also part of what you're talking about is just the sheer energy and scale of New York City and Brooklyn together.
Right.
Not just the rivalry between the two cities. And Brooklyn was at that time a separate city, we should point out, not part of New York as it is now. But New York was the engine that really drove the culture. And, you know, much more so than Boston, which had at one time actually did drive the culture, probably more so than New York or Washington or Philadelphia.
That's true. It's a long story. But, I mean, the result is that all of the national sports publications are coming out of New York and everyone's reading them. The Sporting Life, the Spirit of the Times, they're all coming out of New York City. So everything, the sports coverage is very New York centric. It's actually a lot of New Yorkers who are going to the Midwest and other parts, and California and other parts of the country.
Right. As they move west as part of the kind of social, economic move to broaden out into the West in baseball.
Instead of the present attitude, which is maybe resentment of New York's dominance, in Chicago and in San Francisco, you get teams named after New York teams, even in the South. So anyway, That's an interesting story, and ironic that my biographical subject in this book, Mr. Creighton, was a athletic prodigy, and just almost hard to measure what a great athlete he was. And we don't know the details of how he was discovered, but we know that the first club in Brooklyn, which was called the Excelsiors, and it was a club that was wealthy, it was backed by very wealthy people who lived in Brooklyn Heights. They somehow found Creighton as a teenager and brought him across the East River to another city. He's, as far as I can tell, the first youth athlete ever recruited by a team sport in American history. And something that happens every day now, this is the first time it happened. And poetically enough, is the first person to be called a phenomenon or a phenom.
Phenom, right. Well, and as you also lay out that because baseball was an amateur sport, amateur in quotation marks, in order to get him to play, most likely they had to subsidize his father and brother and sister to come to Brooklyn too when they bought a house.
Right. I mean, there's several things that happened to Creighton that are the first of something, which is the oldest story in sports now. So poor kid from the slums becomes rich and brings his family out of poverty because of his athletic ability. There's an old one. The recruitment story, and you know, we'll get to some of the others. But you know, I spent a lot of time with the topic of the book starts with a bunch of unanswered questions. And there's a shocking number of unanswered questions about this person who had such impact. It was so famous once. Almost nothing about him is really was really well known until I wrote my book. Historians threw up their hands about questions like this, but one of the big ones was he paid and was he actually a professional under the table, which many historians in reference books, if you consult, will say that he was illegally paid. It's just a very complicated question, and he was definitely compensated, and his family was given a rather nice house in Brooklyn Heights, which is still there. It's in the present neighborhood of Cobble Hill, actually. The question is, was that actually considered at the time some kind of infraction against amateurism? Because they had a rule in baseball until 1869 that you could not compensate players. A club could not compensate a player. The problem is there was a lot of play in the rule. And you get, if you really immerse yourself in it, you start realizing that the real bright line was you couldn't give them cash or pay them any kind of salary. But helping the guy get a no-show job or an easy job so that he could play, come to practice. You know, it's the kind of, there were things that were in a gray area that it occurred to me one day. We have the same confusion today over where the line is between amateurism and professionalism. It's not such a bright line as people like to imagine. Olympic athletes are given, you know, equipment contracts and stipends. Different sports have different rules. So I can prove that Creighton was compensated and his family was compensated in different ways. It's interesting that no one ever really formally complained about it. I think a lot of people thought it was okay.
Well, it probably was. I mean, I think that sort of the wink and a nod idea was, how could you expect someone to play baseball at a high level and devote that much time to it without having some form of income or a way of making a living? It ends up, you have to be subsidized in some way.
The great journalist, Henry Chadwick, who was a giant in early baseball history, he actually wrote a column in which he didn't say Creighton's name, but he said, look, you have these clubs and you have people that come from wealthy families or who own their own businesses or who are doctors or lawyers. They have the time and control over their schedule to devote their full efforts to the team. But what about the poor kids who are just good ball players? He says that, don't they deserve some sort of assistance from mutual aid from other club members? That's not wrong. And when you get right down to it, if you actually look at the counterexample of when there were complaints that people had violated, clubs had violated the amateur ethic, they're almost always about what we would call being a mercenary, not being a professional. It's jumping from club to club to go to the highest bidder that was offensive to people. It wasn't necessarily not getting any kind of help, because even some of Creighton's teammates got help.
So one of the things I have to ask you about, because I think this is the part or one of the things that I think was so new to me and I assume would be to anybody else, is that the way the game was played was so different. And we can tick off all of the differences, but there are a couple that are really germane to the story of Creighton as this great pitcher, which is what he was. The first great pitcher, the first dominant pitcher who had, as you point out, it's sort of the anodyne to Babe Ruth in hitting. Creighton was in pitching, that no one had ever done what he did before, and no one was ever as good as he had been or it was prior to him coming along. And what I hadn't really thought about is that they always threw underhand, so that it was much closer to softball as we play it today. But as you pointed out, I think it's not slow pitch softball per se. not fast pitch softball. It was something in between.
Yeah. There are varieties of softball that are similar in terms of their pitching roles and their kind of offensive and defensive balance. Well, we in Brooklyn, we have modified fast pitch where you can't windmill.
Right.
But the difference in Creighton's period was you're literally not allowed to throw. What they call throwing was using bending your elbow and straightening it, and more importantly, snapping your wrist. So those right. things were outlawed. And there is one variety of softball that I talk about in my book where they have the same role. It limits velocity. Well, there's two interesting things about it. It limits velocity to about 40 or 50 miles an hour from 45 feet away, not 60 feet. The other interesting thing is that the reason we call it pitching is because from time immemorial until Creighton, the pitcher had to keep his arm like the hands of a clock, like pitching horseshoes. It had to be straight and dead underhand. So you can see how that would limit velocity. And scores were very high because not only was the pitching relatively slow by our standards, but there's no fielder's gloves.
And also the rule was that the pitcher's job was to pitch the ball in such a way that the hitter could hit it, so that fielding was really, hitting and fielding was the focus of the game, and not the battle between the pitcher and the hitter that we today see as so central to the focus of the way the game works.
Exactly.
That's such a really interesting difference.
You see it in some types of softball, which is basically you put the ball over the plate. It's not that very hard to hit. The batters all get great swings. The batters all hit the ball hard. And the team that converts most hard hit balls into outs wins. So it's scores of 30 to 20 were not anything anyone would be surprised by.
Right.
In fact, in the early 1860s, there was a 7-4 game that made national headlines for being the smallest score.
Low scoring game. And also the catcher becomes much more important because his job is to stop the ball from getting past him more than it is to guide the pitcher in what to throw or frame pitches or anything like that.
Exactly. Often the best athletes are catching.
They didn't have a strike zone. And this is another thing that, so all of this is kind of the ground in which Creighton shows up, you know, a kind of gentleman's game where pitching is not the dominant force. And he comes along and does something that no one has done before, which you describe having to do with, well, the other thing is that the pitchers would run up to the line the way they do in cricket. And he did a single stride pitching motion and twisted his body so that he was getting the force of his legs behind the throw.
Exactly.
No one had ever figured out before.
Even though it's underhand, that's what modern pitchers are doing. Even though Creighton was throwing underhand. Now, one thing to remember, and I've, you know, had interviews where people sort of poo-pooed the idea, what I said in my book, that baseball was baseball in the 1860s. It had traveled most of its evolutionary path toward being what it is now by saying, well, they threw underhand. You know, how's that possible? Well, they're forgetting that major league pitchers threw underhand, low sidearm for decades in the 19th century. Now, overhand pitching comes in the 1890s and 1900s. So there is a gradual lifting of arm angles all through baseball history, and it's on a continuum. It's not that suddenly they decided now we're going to throw overhand.
Right. And of course, and I, as you were describing it in the book, I was thinking about there have been a few submariners in baseball who have a motion that could be similar, even though it obviously they would be illegal if you know, in the rules of baseball in the 1850s. I know that you describe Creighton's hand being so close to the ground as another thing that differentiated him, that he does have that element of the submariner, you know, that
a difficult release point, as they would say now. Anything that's coming from a strange part of your field of vision is going to give hitters trouble. And, you know, I go into great detail about how much faster I thought he was throwing than the standard of the time. And the difficult job for me writing about this was that you're relying on journalistic observers for the most part. Most of them, or nearly all of them, are baffled by what Creighton is doing.
Because they never seen it before.
And they'd never seen it before. They didn't really understand it. And of course, on one level, it's totally unsurprising. And I really was dragged myself kicking and screaming to the conclusion that he threw a curveball. I didn't start out trying to prove that. It never even occurred to me. But as I'm reading descriptions of what he's doing and how he's doing it and trying to piece it together and compare it to illustrations and testimony from hitters, I realized he was throwing a rising underhand curveball. Well, what do you expect people to say when they see a curveball for the first time? You don't expect them to say, oh, look, someone invented the curveball. You expect them to say, what in God's name is that? Which is what they said when they saw him. It's a little more complicated than that because he was a great athlete. So it was a combination of a conceptual breakthrough, the one stride motion, understanding that the torque of opening your closing your hips, then opening them up would generate more power than running toward a line as a cricket bowler does. This is still true. Major league pitchers throw much harder than cricket bowlers bowl. And when you're running forward, of course, you really can't close your hips. It hurts the breaking pitch. But on top of all that, Creighton was very strong and a great, great athlete by any, there's different ways of looking at what a great athlete he was. But there's no question that he's an outstanding athlete, head and shoulders above everyone he's playing with. And he figured out how to do something that some people could imitate, but most people couldn't. This was a problem because he raised the bar for velocity. I mean, I address in the book how fast he was throwing. And because he's throwing from 45 feet away, it's not a simple question of miles per hour. It's a question of reaction time. It's not hard to figure out what people were throwing who were skipping up to a line and flipping the ball dead underhand with a straight arm. They're throwing 40 or 50, absolutely max, which is a little faster from 45 feet away, but it's not very challenging for a hitter. I estimated that Creighton is probably throwing between 70 and 85 miles an hour. Well, you know what that means from 45 feet away?
Yeah, that's like 100 miles an hour.
You're in the low hundreds already.
Yeah.
So it would basically be like if major league pitchers were used to BP fastballs, and then a guy shows up who's throwing Aroldis Chapman or faster. And that's exactly the way they reacted to it. They couldn't hit it. They couldn't even get the bat off their shoulders.
Yeah, it was sort of like the standout of Bob Feller in his era, throwing probably 5 miles, well, 10 miles an hour faster than anybody else.
We're really talking double the expected speed?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the way to think of it is more like suddenly someone shows up in Yankees camp, from Venezuela throwing 180.
Which may happen at some point.
You never know. But of course, one of the first things people would say is, what's he on?
Right. Well, as players get bigger and stronger too, but...
This is a huge leap forward, technique-wise and strength-wise and speed-wise. And Creighton, interestingly, is the first known pitcher to lift weights and one of the first baseball players to lift weights, who was on the cutting edge of the science of weightlifting.
And I think partly what makes the story so compelling is that he died so young and mysteriously, because there was, as you kind of point out, that history was obfuscated for a purpose at that particular time. So there's no real clarity about how he died, although you made some pretty strong inferences.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that we are 100% sure of how he died. And the condition that he died from, he had a hernia and it worsened over time. And it's an inguinal hernia. I actually have one. They're pretty common. Athletes get them all the time. The problem is if it starts widening or tearing open and bits of tissue get caught in it, like intestinal tissue would be the worst, and the blood supply gets cut off, this is how Creighton died. He would have lived with this over a period of years. He probably wore a truss. What I discovered researching it was this is a very well understood medical condition in the 1850s. So I don't think there was ever any doubt about what was wrong with him because he was living with it as an athlete. And I don't think there was ever any doubt of how it killed him, on top of the fact that it was a pretty common medical problem. Unfortunately, in his time, they don't have surgery or antibiotics to address it. So if you happen to be a person that was born this way, and then because of physical strain or bad luck, this thing was opening up and something got caught in there, there was nothing much you could do about it. And he dies of a massive infection, gangrene infection. On top of that, his club is full of medical doctors. Even the president of the club, who's the guy who's doing some of the obfuscating, is very suspicious that he could have gotten up and just explained to the public how Creighton died. And you have to ask yourself, you know, lies are very significant. You have to ask yourself why he let people be confused about it. I don't think the confusion is genuine. People were intentionally confused. And the only conclusion I can come to is that it's not that they killed him on purpose, but they really risked his health knowingly. And we should point out for people who, you know, the vast majority who don't know a lot about amateur era baseball, pitchers are every day, every inning players. And Creighton carried a massive workload in the year 1860, the last full season before the war. And, you know, you can read between the lines of box scores and game accounts and games that he's leaving early and games where he's getting hit, which happened rarely enough, to realize that his health is declining.
And also that he, unlike today, where they control or manage the number of pitches you throw, because there was that rule that hitters could wait for the pitch they wanted to hit. You pointed out that he was throwing, you know, he could be throwing 250 pitches in a game.
And more. And, you know, I did an estimate of how many pitches he threw in an inning. The average today is around 15. So he threw 160 innings that we know of, but it was probably a lot more because they didn't count all the games.
Right.
But in official games, he threw 160 games in 18 innings and 160 innings, averaging at least 45 pitches an inning. So it comes out to over 500 innings by a modern workload standard.
Right, which is hasn't been done in the major leagues since before 1900.
It was, exactly, the 1890s. It was 1892, I think. And to be fair to the Excelsiors, you know, they didn't want to kill him. And they were in uncharted territory. There had never been a pitcher like this before. And they were benefiting so much. You know, we were talking about old stories that Creighton is the first example of. I mean, the oldest story in baseball is that you risk pitchers' health because you need them to get people out. And, okay, they end up on an operating table or their careers are over, and that's just the price of doing business. That's too bad. But Creighton was the first and worst example of this.
And then they obfuscated it because they didn't want to embarrass the game. They were trying to build, promote baseball as a sport. The idea that it might kill you was not really conducive to making people want to play.
That is 100% true. And not only that, it's not just any ball player. It's the one who's pretty much your poster boy for a game that you're trying to sell to the rest of the country. There's the reason why the first baseball card has Creighton on it.
Right.
And it's posthumous. I mean, his fame was massive and enduring.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, I can kind of think about how long does oral history last? And I think there were people talking about him who had either a direct or indirect connection to him for another 60 years, at least.
Yeah, and, you know, by bad luck, a lot of the people that were most closely involved with him were either out of baseball, dead, or disappeared for various reasons. It was an interesting question to ask when people, you know, in the 1890s and 1900s started asking who threw the first curveball, for instance, or where did modern pitching really come from? All the people around Creighton, a lot of them were gone. His catcher was, that's an interesting part of my story, but he was living under a pseudonym and on the run from the law.
Right. He's an interesting character by himself.
Yeah. So I say in the book that history is made up of stories and they're not all true. So this Creighton story, it wasn't a good fit. And it was a combination of a little bit of forgetting and a lot of not wanting to go to an unpleasant subject. and other people having better stories that were more compelling. And probably the third factor is baseball history used to be written by journalists. If you were a fun guy to have a beer with and tell stories to, you could end up in the Hall of Fame because of that. I can give you some examples.
Yeah. Well, and in this case, he's not around to proclaim that he was the first pitcher to throw a curveball and someone else was. That guy, Arthur Candy Cummings, who took on that role and ends up being proclaimed the first, partially because he proclaimed it himself.
He did. He campaigned and he was a popular guy, was around forever. He also had a compelling story. Most of people have heard it, if you've read his baseball history books, that he was throwing clamshells on a beach in Brooklyn. Now, that makes absolutely no sense. I mean, the way a clamshell moves through the air has nothing to do with how a baseball curves. But it's a great mental image and it helps tell the story.
Right. And the other interesting fact is that he was a protege of Joe Leggett, who was the catcher who caught Jim Creighton. So there is some, you know, he may have been taught the curveball and there's no one around to dispute because Leggett's not around and Creighton's not around. There's no one to dispute his story.
I think one of the most suspicious things about Candy Cummings' story is that he's told it many times and there were variations, but he never mentions Leggett's name.
Right. Which is, right, I know there's always the thing about liars. Liars always omit some key detail that might otherwise impeach them.
If you're saying that you did it yourself, you're not going to mention the guy that found you when you were 14, taught you how to pitch.
Right.
Coached you, trained you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much more that we could talk about. We barely touched the surface. And I think it's actually a kind of a signal of how great this book is, whether you are a baseball fan or not. And I think that goes to the fact that you're really writing cultural, social history through a lens. I mean, baseball is definitely the lens, but I don't think you have to be a baseball fan to enjoy this book.
That's what I had in mind when I wrote it.
Well, I think you succeeded. So I'm sorry that we don't have time for more because I think we could have talked at least another half an hour about it. So I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you. Those were great questions. I enjoyed it.
The book is Death in the Strike Zone, The Mystery of America's First Baseball Hero, Thomas W. Gilbert. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been very pleased to be here. Thank you.